Hey, it's Craig. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Canadian History X early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Greetings and welcome to a special episode of Canadian History X. Before I continue, you can support the podcast by going to Patreon at patreon.com/CanadaX. We have multiple tiers for you to choose from, and every dollar that you give helps support the podcast and keep it going. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing an author of a book I greatly enjoyed. For Christmas, my wife had bought me the book An Irish Heart, which tells the tale of a small immigrant community that shaped Canada and Montreal, called Griffintown. I really enjoyed this book. It was a fascinating read, and it helped give me a lot of information that I was able to use on the podcast for future episodes. So, I sat down to interview the author Sharon about her book and about Griffintown itself. So I hope you enjoy this special episode of the podcast.
I kind of caught the end of an era. There were so many characters there. It was a lot of the houses were smaller, brick row houses. So a lot of the living was out on the streets. In the summers, people would bring chairs out, sit on the sidewalk, hang from the windows. People would walk around, and there were all these old-timers telling amazing stories. And the other part, it was a real community, a real sense of community that focused around St. Anne's Parish and the church. And it was a very rich parish in the activities. The priest had set up a St. Anne's Young Men's Society. So there was... All through the ages, there have been concerts and drama and debates. And so I think, as I said, I think I caught the end of an era. It was a bit like at the time, if any of you have seen the old Bells of St. Mary's movies with priests and nuns with Irish brogues and the tough-sized Carter guys sitting on the corner. There are people like famous Father Carney, who used to sit on the steps of St. Anne's waving at taxis and entertaining the local kids. We had a very colorful politician that I think his career there lasted 30, 40 years. He was a former jockey, prided himself on being carried out of the Quebec legislature three times, always in a battle with Montreal Mayor Jean Drapeau. And there were people like Nellie Cowden, who was called the Queen of Griffintown, kind of ironically, because this Queen of Griffintown might show up at a wedding with wearing her gray flannel slippers with holes cut out for her bunions. But at the same time, if somebody was hungry and needed a meal, you knew you could go to Nellie Cowden. So there are all these stories, and even I sort of caught the end of an era, but some of the stories I was hearing from the elderly people in the neighborhood, there were stories about floods and fires and plane crashes, all within our neighborhood of Griffintown. People like, I remember Jimmy MacArthur, a very elegant gentleman, pointing with his cane to the second floor windows where the flood levels used to go. And I remember thinking, wow, did that really happen? And it's all these questions that eventually my curiosity led to figure out what wanted to read about it. My uncle, Frankie Doyle, used to tell stories about being in school in April 1944 when the RAF bomber scooped down over the school. It had encountered engine problems, and it ended up crashing into a block of houses one street over, killing 14 people. And there was all these sort of stories around all these events. There's a story of Happy Furlong, who everybody says, oh yeah, Happy, his life was saved by a bottle of beer, because just before the plane crash, he got a hankering for a pint, wandered off from his room to buy a bottle of beer. Meanwhile, if he had stayed and skipped the bottle of beer, he would have died in that plane crash. And there were legends. There's a legend of the headless woman all of us, we were warned about the ghost of Mary Gallagher, a headless woman who haunted the intersection of William and Murray Streets. That was based on an actual murder, I later found out, Mary Gallagher was a prostitute, and a jealous rival chopped off her head in a flat in Griffintown in 1860s or 70s, and threw the head in a bucket. And the Montreal papers at the time were splashed with this horrific crime, and people came from far and wide to see the house where this happened. But it sort of descended by the time I came around. It was down to the legend of the headless woman, and all of us kids would run by that intersection. And there was humor too. Like it became a favorite story of Father McEntee, a priest who grew up in the neighborhood. And then later, years after the church was pulled down and people were feeling quite sentimental about the neighborhood, he set up ghost watches on the actual date of her murder on the grounds of the old church, and they would have a mass and a party afterwards, of course, after this ghost watch. And Griffintown was a paradox. Outsiders at the time looked at us as a poor, rundown slum full of hooligans. A lot of people were afraid to walk the streets. And actually, I have even as late as I am, when I was at university, one night a fellow from McGill walked me home, and he told me later he was scared stiff as we passed this corner with these big tough guys hanging out there. But when I got to the corner, I said, "Oh, hi, Pete. Hi, how are you?" But it was sort of misunderstood. At the same time, residents kind of cherished the reputation. It was a bit uncalled for, although in the earlier days there had been some real tough guys, but people were really sentimental about it and loved it. And a lot of times sing songs would end with a few verses of, "Oh, take me back to Griffintown, take me back to Griffintown, the place I belong." So it's full of paradoxes. At the time too, there were some people, a few of the snobbier people who lived in Griffintown would never admit to, if they were in another part of the city, that they were from Griffintown, because it was had such a bad reputation.
Right.
The ironic thing is now that actually it's just sort of a sea of high rises, and now they've stretched it. Three neighborhoods beyond are calling themselves Griffintown because they've got art galleries and boutiques there. Oh, another paradox was Firecracker Day. They have had this in other places in Canada, but people got really excited about Firecracker Day in Griffintown. For weeks ahead of May 24th, people would start stockpiling old furniture, newspapers, anything flammable in the sheds. And on Firecracker Day, usually the young guys, teenagers, would pull us all out with the tacit approval of most of the adults, and they put bonfires in the middle of the street, and the firemen would be going out quenching one, quenching the other, and this was all considered great entertainment. And by little old ladies would pull their rocking chairs out to the sidewalk, and these little old ladies would be throwing firecrackers in. So that was pretty exciting. But then a week or two later, these same what some people would call hooligans, we're getting ready for the Corpus Christi procession. The guys who were lighting bonfires were now painting the shutters. Little old ladies were making altars and putting flowers under the altars for the procession for Corpus Christi. So there were all these paradoxes that I found kind of amazing looking back on it. It was very very religious area. You would see a lot of people trailing off to 6 o'clock masses on weekday mornings before going to work. And St. Anne's Church, the beloved church, which was torn down, unfortunately, in 1970, became the place of Tuesday devotions, where some people said there were miracles happening. And they, at the height of it, in, I guess in the 1950s would have been the one I remember, there were 6 services a day, and they would, the city put on extra buses to come down to the church, and people would be filling out their little request forms for what they wanted help with. Although a lot of young women who have a secret prayer that they didn't write down would be, "Good St. Anne, find me a man." there was a lot of humor. I mean, it was, I don't want to play down the difficulties. There was poverty, but there was a pride in the poverty. I mean, everybody, you had to keep your house spotlessly clean. Didn't matter. Soap and water didn't cost anything, people would say. And even though by the time I came around, it was still considered an Irish community, although, of course, a lot of other nationalities had moved in by then. But I remember sitting on the steps with my friends, and we were all trying to argue who was the most Irish. And somebody would say, "Oh, you can't be because your grandmother was Polish." Or, but it somehow, even though it wasn't as homogeneous as in earlier years, it still felt very Irish. And St. Patrick's Day was huge. It was, you always went home for St. Patrick's Day if you were away. St. Anne's would put concerts in the hall, and these would be full plays with dancers and singers, and people would come to St. Anne's Hall from around the city for these plays that they would put on maybe every night for a week. Montreal, until this year, until this week, had the longest running parade in North America. They've never missed one since 1824. I mean, some places had started them earlier, but there were breaks for various reasons. Now, in 1918, the organizers of the parade, the Irish community from all over Montreal, decided that they would cancel the St. Patrick's Day parade. After all, it was wartime. There was a conscription crisis going on. And frankly, some Irish young men thought there might be conscription agents out looking for these young Irishmen who were trying to evade being conscripted because they didn't want to fight for England. Their loyalty still lay with Ireland. The men of Griffintown, the members of the St. Anne's Young Men's Society, defied the decree, put on their top coat, their dress coats, their top hats and shamrocks, and walked the parade route to keep the continuity. So I'm fascinated to see this year, and my brothers actually are members of the United Irish Society's, the organization who in Montreal right now run the parade. And while everywhere in Ireland, New York, Boston, they've canceled the parade, in Montreal, they're saying they're postponing it. So I don't, it's just really sad. I guess they don't want to break this record of the longest running parade. So I know we might be celebrating it in July. The St. Anne's Young Men's Society would also put on their top hats and top coats and form a procession every spring to the Black Rock. The Black Rock is an enormous boulder that marks a spot where the bones of 6,000 Irish famine immigrants died in Montreal in 1847 because of the typhus that they had come down with on the ships. Now, that rock was put up by the men building the Victoria Bridge. When they were digging the bridge, they found some bones and recognized them as being these survivors. And up until that point, somewhere in the 1870s, I think, no marker had been placed on that massive grave. So they rolled up this boulder from that they had found in the construction and put it up. And to this day, that is the only marker of this great tragedy. But the local Irish of Griffintown, the men's of it was a men's thing then, and now women do the walk too, but they would walk to the stone and have a religious ceremony in their memory. Now, when I was growing up, I lived and went to a school barely a mile away from that site of this huge tragedy. And I never heard anything about it in our history books, history classes, nowhere. Mm-hmm. So I always wondered about that. The little I knew was from the stories and traditions handed down to generations of Irish descendants. So a lot of that was what motivated me. So it was quite astounding to me to dig up all the stories from that summer of sorrow. The mayor of Montreal died. He went down to the fever sheds where they placed the sick people, most of whom died. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of any other city or country that wouldn't mark that spot. And at the time, the numbers are astounding. Some 50,000 Irish immigrants landed in Montreal at that time. Backing up a bit, Griffintown was kind of a landing spot. Almost all the Irish who came to Canada in that century came through the port of Montreal. And then they would take, because the huge ships couldn't go up the St. Lawrence, so they'd have to transfer to smaller boats. So even most of the Irish who came and ended up in Ontario or Point Sion would have known Griffintown and have passed through. So that year, 1847, 50,000 Irish immigrants came through Montreal. At that time, the population of the city was 100,000. So you can imagine now with this coronavirus, if we had, you know, the population, say, of Toronto is roughly, GTA, 3 million. If we had 1.5 million people coming through the city, what that did to the city was incredible. And yet, it is, until recent years, it was really almost ignored. And also digging out, I realized that Griffintown, well, it has a lot of sentimental value for the Montreal Irish and for families like mine, but in my research, I found the people of Griffintown had an important political role. They had, for a time, a balance of power in the struggle between the French and the British, although it was very difficult and really time-consuming. It took me nearly 5 years of research to tease out where the Irish were, because they were always kind of lumped in with the British. But the residents of Griffintown were critical to the election of Darcy McGee and eventually to Confederation. He made one of his famous speeches to a crowd out in the streets of Griffintown. And actually, I discovered that the Irish produced some of Canada's first terrorists. Not that we should be too proud of that, but Athenians, who were a small group of fanatics devoted to liberating Ireland from the British Crown, tried to blow up the Parliament buildings in Ottawa in a misguided attempt to further the cause. Happily, they didn't blow up the Parliament buildings. They were caught ahead of time. But a lot of the secret meetings were held in safe houses, and I found out in buildings in Griffintown that I knew later. And of course, there's more written about the Lachine Canal was built through Griffintown and by a lot of residents of Griffintown. The area was Canada's first industrial center. Sadly, Griffintown right now has been almost largely wiped out. The destruction of the neighborhood began in earnest in the 1960s. Excuse me. As Montreal prepared for Expo 67, Mayor Drapeau was determined to make the city look pristine, and he didn't. He was having constant political battles with Frank Hanley, our representative at the time. anyway, Drapeau seemed to use, to a lot of us, use Expo 67 as an excuse to wipe out Griffintown. He built the Bonaventure Expressway through, right through the neighborhood, cutting out that swath of the, about a third of the buildings went down. He also rezoned the district to industrial. So, and that prevented, there's some bylaws, any renovation of the building. So gradually the housing stock began to deteriorate. People started to move out. Landlords would tear down buildings. And the area was left basically empty until, for a few decades, until roughly, I guess, in the early 2000s. It was rezoned again, and developers seem to have been given free rein on, and they've taken advantage of it, because Griffintown is ideally located. It's immediately west, or it could be south of it, with the river, get my directions a little mixed up, immediately next to Old Montreal, and immediately south of downtown Montreal and Peel and St. Catharines. So it's an ideal location. And they've left all the small streets intact, but almost all of the old buildings, which could have been renovated and added some charm, like Toronto's Cabbage Town, like Vancouver's Gas Town, that's almost all gone. And now it's just a sea of high-rises. And some of the high-rises are fine, but there's such a jumble of them, and on the narrow streets and shadows. And so, if, like the history has been, the site has been totally wiped out. And in another political move that's really angering the Irish community of Montreal, the city, the mayor has decided to name the station for a new LRT that's going through the city after a French separatist. You know, rather than naming it after Griffintown, or perhaps maybe after the Irish famine immigrants who died, like, there would be absolutely no Irish reference to this really colorful and important part of our history. The latest I heard was that the mayor had now saying, well, she might reconsider, but no, nothing. And the marker, the Irish community has been fighting for a park, mm-hmm. To honor these famine immigrants who died, and also the memory of the Montreal residents who cared for them during that time. And if I already mentioned that this boulder now stands on a small traffic island in the middle of a 6-lane freeway leading to the Victoria Bridge. So you have to kind of take your life in your hands, you know, and stand near this bridge. And I go into my book, too. There is a bit of history, because that rock proved to be quite inconvenient to some other plans for railways and bridges. And if at one point it was moved in the dead of night so people wouldn't see it being moved, but it, after some efforts, it was brought back closer to the spot. So that's Griffintown. Very special place. And it's it's got a special place in a lot of people's hearts.
And you said you researched for 5 years on that one thing. How long did it take overall to research everything?
This project started in 2003. I wanted to write this book since I was 10 years old, but I kind of got waylaid, and I was writing for Maclean's for many 20 years, and got caught up in the excitement of doing that. as I got older, it was really nagging at me. So March 2003, I wrote a cover story for Maclean's about Griffintown. And a few months later, a publisher, a HarperCollins editor, called and asked if I'd like to write a book about the Irish. Now, at that time, I knew very little about the history of the Irish in Canada. So it was almost like doing a master's degree, really. And I was very fortunate to find a mentor in Professor Peter Toner, now retired, from the University of New Brunswick. So he led my research and helped me to gather all the information I needed from the Maritimes, and his specialty was D'Arcy McGee, so he was really helpful in gathering the history. But I also wanted not to write a plain history book where this happened, that happened. I wanted to dig really deep to get people's stories, to get anecdotes. So that meant I went to dozens of archives. I did over 60 oral history interviews. I started in 2004. The book came out in 2010, although the last couple years were mostly editing and gathering photos. And mm-hmm. Yeah, so a long time.
And where can people get it?
Get the book?
Yeah.
It's available online through Indigo. It's in, happily, a number of bookstores still carry it. The hardcover is sold out, but it's still available in paperback.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.